you're navigating something, but it's almost as if you've got a blindfold on without rage, because it's such a labyrinth.
Hello and welcome to the Waterstones podcast. I'm Will Rycroft, and things are about to get a little heated. Anyone who has spent more than 5 minutes on social media platforms like Twitter will know that discussion there is often fueled by outrage. Commentators provoke it, we respond with it, individuals and brands are constantly getting cancelled before the debate moves on somewhere else, and the temperature rises once again. But is all this outrage helping to make the world a better place, or are we in fact allowing it to distract us from real activism that provokes change? Presenter and DJ Dottie Charles explores all of these ideas in her book Outraged: Why Everyone is Shouting and No One is Talking. And it was my very great pleasure to speak to her about it a few weeks ago. Dottie, thank you for joining me, first of all.
Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. We are going to be talking about outrage, and I have to say that this is something that I have wanted to talk about for quite some time. Not as an angry person, but because I've lived my life on social media for over a decade now, and I sort of feel like I've seen the atmosphere change a little bit on social media. It seems to have got angrier and angrier, and the tone of people's sort of language and exchange, especially on somewhere like Twitter, seems to have got much more outraged. Does it feel that way to you?
Absolutely. I think the social media landscape has changed dramatically. If you look at, if we're going to use Twitter as an example, if you look at Twitter 10 years ago, which is actually when I joined in 2010, and you compare it to 2020, they are worlds apart, not only in sort of how user-friendly it has become, but also in just the absolute hostility that you find there. It's a completely different place now.
It really is. I'm like you. I think probably 2009 is when I started using Twitter in earnest. And I remember it then as being a place where I was involved in sort of books and book reviews and talking to people about books. And it was a lovely place. People were there recommending books, getting involved in nice, friendly hashtags to sort of share their favorite books and talk about literature and translation. And maybe I'm remembering it with rose-tinted spectacles, but I don't remember there being a lot of angry exchanges, whereas now you can barely mention a book or an author without somebody often jumping in to tell you why you're wrong or why they're disgusted with what you say. And I hear this word disgust all the time as well. There's a lot of disgust and anger and outrage, and it's that sort of, the pitch of discussion is so sort of febrile and violent now. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I think, don't get me wrong, Twitter in 2010, it did still have this sort of subtext of angry exchange. I think there was a sort of an underworld where these exchanges were happening. I think now, though, it's become the overriding theme of the platform, which I think is where the big change has happened. It's no longer sort of, oh, there was a bit of outrage here, there was a bit of outrage there, as it was maybe 10 years ago. It seems to just be a resounding noise. And as you say, it's all outrage, it's all disgust. And you can't avoid it now.
I wondered where the sort of starting point was for you. If you could tell me a little bit about where this idea of writing about this theme came to you, first of all.
Well, I'll take you back to the birth of the book, which was actually on a family holiday. We were on a family holiday in Thailand. And I just, as you do sometimes on holiday, I thought I'll just tap in and just see what's happening back in Blighty, and just have a little scroll on my Twitter feed. And it was the day, I'm not sure if you remember, it was January 2018, and H&M were being dragged through the thorny bushes of Twitter for a hoodie that they had put on a black boy that said, "Coolest monkey in the jungle." And it was met with, absolute outrage from all corners, really, of the internet. And I remember looking at it and thinking, okay, I feel like I'm supposed to be outraged right now, but I'm not. And I think many people reach that crossroads, especially if you're an active social media user, where you just feel as though the way you feel is completely against the current of Twitter. You feel as though you're at odds with the mass opinion. So I wrote an article for The Guardian kind of unpacking outrage and why I wasn't angry about this hoodie. I didn't see it as H&M being racist. I thought, worst case scenario, there was some. It was very clumsy, and I think it was probably symptomatic of what their marketing boardroom looked like. In that nobody would even probably question putting out an image like that. But I wasn't outraged. I didn't see it as top of the agenda when it comes to fighting racism. I saw other things taking priority over a H&M hoodie. And I wrote the article, Will, and I was expecting a bit of backlash. And in fact, I realised in that moment when I started to get feedback about this article that I wrote for The Guardian, that many people were in this position where they kind of outrage refugees, in that you kind of don't know where you're supposed to be. You're kind of in limbo because you want to be on the right side of morality, right? So you're like, yeah, okay, should I just be angry with everyone else and just make sure that I'm managing the perception of myself in being that I'm on the right side of morality, I'm on the right side of history. But sometimes you're just not outraged. And I think that is because not all outrage is warranted on the scale that it is communicated. And the scale of this H&M thing was global. I mean, you had Diddy weighing in and The Weeknd saying he was no longer going to work with them. And there was a riot in a H&M in South Africa. And it all stemmed from the tweet of one woman in Battersea. And it kind of had this spiraling effect. So I thought, I'm going to write this book because on paper, I've got a lot to be angry about, Will. Society was kind of not built to be kind to me. I'm black, I'm gay, I'm a woman. I think if we were going to be playing a game of outrage top trumps, I would win every time. Because there's just so much that I could be outraged by. And I thought, okay, if anybody can kind of have a sobering look at outrage, it's going to be me. So I thought I'd just kind of take the subject matter on, and it is vast. There's outrage on every given day, in every given corner of the world about an array of subjects. So I was never going to be able to write an outrage encyclopedia. It's just too, as I say, it's just too vast. Outrage dates all the way back to, we could do a book about outrage and the suffragettes. It's a huge topic. So I thought, rather than trying to create an all-encompassing encyclopedia of outrage, I'd kind of, for want of a better word, make a roadmap, in that I study different areas of outrage and see where I land. I wasn't going into this as an authority on our responses. I wasn't going in as somebody who was going to police outrage. It was more me kind of figuring out how we've ended up here and how we can be a bit more effective.
There are a few sort of topics that you deal with, and I think one that we should definitely talk about today, given everything that's going on in the world. I mean, we should mention we're recording this in the midst of this reaction to the killing of George Floyd in America. And in fact, today is his funeral. And we have seen genuine outrage and indeed activism on the streets. We've seen marches, we've seen statues being toppled, and a real call for genuine change. And I thought what was really interesting after reading your book, where you talk about the difference between real activism, which is people trying to make change happen, and what you call clicktivism, which is people doing the bare minimum on a social channel like Twitter or Instagram or whatever to kind of virtue signal that they're on the right side, as you say, the right side of a moral argument by clicking or sharing something. And then that's kind of it. You must look at what's happening at the moment, particularly as a black woman, as you mentioned, who's got, you know, you've got your top trumps, the sort of the groups that you are part of.
Yeah.
And to see what feels like a very different moment right now, where there is something genuinely shifting, genuinely changing, with people talking about actually making a difference rather than just paying lip service. Does it feel like that to you?
Absolutely. And I think, look, outrage that isn't rooted in activism, it will never bear the fruit of change, right? So if you're outraged because of somebody stumbled and used incorrect phrasing that offended you for a moment, that outrage is not going to bear anything because it's not rooted in activism. It's not, there's no real impetus behind your outrage. It's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to something disposable, right? Mm. I think when there's a goal behind your outrage, what we see is a very different set of circumstances. And the Black Lives Matter movement at the moment has mobilized a generation of people that actually, they have a motive, there is a goal. And it's really powerful to be a part of this community right now, Will, because it really feels as though this is so much more than a social media moment. And of course, there will always be people that align themselves with a movement on social media alone. But it feels as though this is spilling out into the real world in ways that really creates change. And it's because we're doing the practical work to impose the desired effects of our online outrage. It's not just sitting online, as it so often does. It's really tangible. And it's quite an empowering moment, actually.
It's certainly a very exciting moment. I mean, one thing that happens, I speak as somebody who sits behind, I guess, a corporate Twitter account and sort of social media channels, and has to sort of face, you talk about how sometimes it feels really good to kick a brand, you know, because they're there and they probably need taking down a peg or two. And of course, they're slightly faceless. Obviously, there is a person on the other side. And in this case, it's me. But, you know, I think the recent events were really interesting. So, for example, the day before what was called Blackout Tuesday, we had shared an updated reading list, you know, books that you might want to read if you're looking to sort of self-educate yourself around these themes around Black Lives Matter. And then literally overnight, people had decided that Blackout Tuesday was going to be a thing. And then we got a lot of people asking why we weren't posting something on Blackout Tuesday. And it was because simply we had posted it late on Monday night. And then I did post it again, and then I used the hashtag, and then somebody said we shouldn't be using the hashtag because it stops the real posts appearing. And I said, no, but I think you're supposed to use the hashtag if you're sharing something which is useful, but not use the hashtag if you're just doing the blackout square thing, which somebody had decided was what the campaign was. So then I got rid of the hashtag, and then somebody said, oh, look how quickly they took down the hashtag because a white person asked them to. And then I was just really confused. I was thinking, I don't know that I can get this right, because there was outrage on all sides, because of course the rules of engagement hadn't really been sorted beforehand, because of course it's a living, breathing moment, this sort of how we react to what's going on. And at the end of the day, what I really wanted to do was to say, if you are looking for books about this, this is where they are, this is where you can find them. I mean, do you find where you work, obviously at the within the BBC, do you feel that that has changed since you've been there? Do you see positive change happening within somewhere like the BBC?
I think, just to touch on what you mentioned previously, when you said you just wanted to get it right, and you kind of you're navigating something, but it's almost as if you've got a blindfold on with outrage, because it's such a labyrinth, and there are so many voices, and there is so much noise in the social media space that I don't think anybody can ever truly get it right consistently. Because there's always going to be a dissenting voice, whether you're Waterstones or whether you're the BBC. There's going to be somebody who you cannot appease. And I think that is part of why outrage is so frustrating, but also so fascinating. Because we're all entitled to get outraged. And I think now more than ever, we are really vocalizing that entitlement. Take for example the graffiti on the Churchill statue. You've got outrage on both sides, and everybody thinks that their outrage is more warranted than the other side. And because of that, when you are a brand, I think the most difficult thing is you're trying to be all things to all people. You don't get to be fallible in the way that a human being can. You're a brand. You have to get it right, and you have to please all people that buy into or subscribe to your brand. And I think the BBC in particular is in a difficult position, in that it needs to be kind of politically neutral, at all times. And then the question arises, when does neutrality go out the window?
Mm.
You know, racism, for example, there's no neutral. There's only the right way. There's no, do you know what I mean? There's no tone you can take to appease everybody, because the only angle you can take is anti-racism. There's no neutrality in that. And I think for brands, the difficulty is in figuring out when you do need to be very loud and very proud in your allegiances, which I wouldn't want to run the Waterstones social media, that's for sure.
Well, it's a tricky thing. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a person who's passionate about books, and so that's taken me to various places, you know, in my work, and I'm just as passionate now about books as I am now, and for the same reason I always was, which is that books contain the answers to the questions that we ask ourselves on a daily basis, I think. And I would never pretend to know the answers to these questions, but I do know where I can find them, and books have always been a great solace, and I love putting books in people's hands. And I think we all accept as well that all brands and all businesses have got plenty of work to do when it comes to tackling something like racism. And it does actually feel now as if there is an energy in that sort of that well-meaning quest, if you like, to actually make concrete change happen, to really sort of look at what you're doing and go, is that good enough? Could I do better? How do we improve this? This is, you know, these conversations are definitely happening where I work. I'm sure they're happening in other workplaces. We can only hope that they will continue to happen and that we'll see real change happen. To sort of, I suppose, to come back to that idea of outrage, you talk to some of the outrage mongers, if you like, the people who almost have made a career out of outrage on social media.
Yes.
And I mean people like Katie Hopkins. Tell us a little bit about talking with her, because I think it's very easy with somebody like her to kind of go, she's an evil person and we put her in this box. Yeah. But you talk about how confusing it is to sort of talk with her on a one-to-one basis and sort of confront some of the things that she says and does. Tell us about Katie.
Well, Katie Hopkins is a big enigma, and it's very conflicting for somebody like me. So I enter a conversation with Katie Hopkins as the sort of person that she would actively antagonize. Katie Hopkins kind of, she picks her targets. They tend to be minorities. Very, very, very often she takes aim at the LGBTQ community. And so I am kind of the embodiment of a Katie Hopkins dartboard, so to speak. So I went into this very much kind of knowing that, with an awareness of exactly what she stands for and exactly what that means for somebody like me. But I also approached it with a great deal of cynicism, because while I wrote this book and I began to unpack outrage, I realized how lucrative the business of outrage is. I realized how much engagement an individual can get by being provocative and by eliciting that feeling of outrage. People that make people angry have bigger careers and more notoriety than those who you're indifferent towards. So I realized that what Katie Hopkins may well have created here was just a brand of villainy. So when you go into a conversation with somebody half hating them beforehand, but half undermining the validity of that feeling, and whether you're actually you've kind of been played, you know, have I been played by Katie Hopkins into hating her? So I approached the conversation in that dichotomy, and it ended up being one of the most interesting, confusing, conflicting conversations of my life with Katie Hopkins, because she's insufferable, isn't she? I think we can agree that Katie Hopkins is insufferable. My question when meeting her, and it kind of wasn't a question, it was an ongoing analysis. It was, is this insufferable person the work of an evil genius? And that is what I was kind of exploring when speaking to her. it wasn't so much about her views. It was more about the mechanic that she has used and how those views are the vehicle for her fame. And I think she's one of many that have mastered the art of outrage. It's the, look, there's a reason why me and you right now are speaking about Katie Hopkins in 2020, despite her coming like eighth in The Apprentice series three or something, you know? There's a reason why we don't, I would challenge you to name another five Apprentice contestants by both first name and surname. I think even an Apprentice super fan would struggle to give you forename surname of somebody that was on the show a decade ago. And that is testament to, I think, how we've been played by Katie Hopkins.
Well, as you say, like there are those people who have made a career out of stoking that outrage, and we do know their names. We know both of their names, you know, surname and first name.
Right.
Because, as you say, that's how they maintain their brand. So Richard Littlejohn, Piers Morgan, these people who know exactly how to get people frothing at the mouth. And that, of course, is exactly what they want. I mean, what is the best thing to do? Is it the old adage that your mum or dad might have said to them, which is just to ignore? You ignore the school bully so that they just get bored of taunting you, or they just find another way of stoking outrage?
No, I think there is, as simple as it sounds, there is so much power in disengagement. I think something that I've learned while writing this book is I think we believe that in order to conquer our adversaries, we have to engage in combat. And that's kind of, I think that's human nature, isn't it? You think, like, if I'm going to take this thing on, I'm going to physically take it on. And if I can't stand Katie Hopkins, I'm going to give her what for, and I'm going to get really angry in her Twitter mentions, and I'm going to engage in an exchange with her. I think now, especially in the social media age where our exposure and our engagement is our currency, I think the more you strip that away, the less powerful these individuals become. And there is so much power in muting a Katie Hopkins. If everybody who has ever been offended by Katie Hopkins had ignored her, the monster would have died many, many years ago. Because it's not the people that agree with Katie Hopkins that have made her famous.
Mm.
It's the people that disagree with Katie Hopkins that have allowed her to build this brand. And look, being more effective in our outrage is more than just not being outraged. I think that's a really two-dimensional conclusion to draw. Oh, just don't engage. And I think you'll realize that as you read the book, anybody who reads the book will realize that it's not just about not engaging, but it's about realizing when to engage, how long to engage for, how to engage. And I think with somebody like Katie Hopkins, the answer is categorically to disengage. And then you stop feeding the monster, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, one point you make really strongly towards the end of the book is that what outrage does is act as a distraction to what we should be doing, which is activism. That these social media networks are basically designed around the idea that negative emotions will always trump positive emotions. It's much easier and quicker to make a negative response to something. And that's why you'll see those things trending on Twitter or wherever it is every day. And it stops you from actually doing something to make any change. And you talk about looking to the past and looking at examples of how people got out on streets, marched, congregated, got together. Of course, we're living in a period at the moment where even congregating becomes a potentially dangerous, but also a political act because of being told by people that you're not allowed to be congregating in groups of six or more. And then, of course, Black Lives Matter marches at the weekend had thousands of people getting together saying this is more important than your rules about sort of social gatherings. Again, would this be the perfect example, in a way, of what you're talking about in your book, which is that you need to get the finger away from the sort of touchscreen phone and out there on the streets with people, taking physical, sort of making your physical presence felt and actually sort of enforcing some kind of change to happen?
I think the effects of outrage should always be progress, right? And there are many avenues to progress, one of which is protest. I think protest is a great way to physically pursue change. But at the same time, that's not to undermine the many other ways that you can pursue change. You know, there may be people who haven't gone out to protest, but they have engaged in a really important dialogue with senior staff members in their place of work. There may be people that are writing letters, that are speaking to their local MPs. I think the most important thing for me is to realize that, look, the revolution is not going to happen online. And in order to see an effect on your outrage, if that effect is what you desire, let's be clear. Some people are outraged, not because they are in pursuit of anything, just because that is how they have chosen to use the social media space, right? But for people who really desire change, who desire a return on investment based on how much they're putting into a cause, it's so important to make sure that, or even if the dialogue begins online, that cannot be where it ends. It needs to have some real world impetus in order to have any effect at all.
It used to be, we always sort of make this joke even nowadays, which is that, you know, if you were annoyed about something, you'd write a strongly worded letter to your MP or to the boss of a company. But actually, weirdly, sort of that kind of thing can have more impact in the real world than just simply you firing off a tweet to your mate saying that you're outraged about something. We've seen the sort of the rise of online petitions and organizations like that in order to try and mobilize people. And it seems to me that that's where social media can be really useful, because it's a great way of mobilizing big groups of people to sign something.
Yeah.
But there's also the danger that they will sign something without even really looking at what it means, because of course it feels good to be part of a crowd, to be part of sometimes something close to a mob, you know, because that is a way of signaling how you feel about something. Do people, as you have done in your book, through talking to people like Katie Hopkins or Rachel Dolezal, people like that, do people have to realize that there is more nuance to these things than the sort of slightly more black and white aspect that you might think of things when you see them on social media? Does it require a little bit more effort from people?
I think we just need to be, we need to be diligent in our outrage. We need to be diligent and we need to be vigilant, because look, not everything requires our outrage. You just mentioned Rachel Dolezal, who is somebody that I also interviewed for the book. As she's somebody who kind of woke up one day the subject of international outrage. And I think Rachel Dolezal's story is kind of symptomatic of what is wrong with outrage. I think if anybody doesn't remember the Rachel Dolezal story, she was exposed in 2015 as a white woman that had been pretending to be black. Now, although of course there are many issues that you can unpack there, but in the grand scheme of things, the way one woman who lives in Spokane, Washington, how she decides to identify herself is not, it does not warrant international outrage. And I think it's about figuring out what does and doesn't need our outrage. And we've got so much more control over our output, I think, than we give ourselves credit for. When we're online, if you're a user of Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, it can be very tempting to, as I mentioned earlier, just kind of go with the current. Wherever the conversation is leading, you kind of feel, well, this is what we're talking about. This is where I need to go. And if Katie Hopkins is top of the agenda, or Rachel Dolezal is top of the agenda, we feel obliged to contribute to that conversation, when in reality, we don't. And it's about realizing when to engage and when to disengage. But as you say, it feels great to be a part of a crowd. It feels great to be part of the mob, because you feel as though when you're with the majority, you feel as though you're doing something right, isn't it? So it's a huge thing to unpack, which is why it took a book to even begin scratching the surface. But it's not, you know what, it's not a simple case of virtue signaling either. I think that's another quite rudimentary way of looking at it, is that there's lots of people online who are just pretending to be outraged because it makes them look moral. And there is a huge amount of virtue signaling going on online, but we're motivated to be outraged for so many reasons. And I think when we realize what's motivating us to be outraged, we can begin to channel and control our responses a bit better. Because I realized with this book, I go down a bit of neuroscience as well to look at the psychological reasons why we engage. And it's made, just writing the book made me so much more aware of how and why I react. And it's really helped me actually take better control of my outrage.
As you say, because you can feel the trigger and you kind of go, no, I would have got outraged at this point, but now I realize that's a waste of my time and energy and I can put it elsewhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because look, we all belong to different groups, right? And if we look at those as our tribes, right? So for example, Will, if somebody was attacking the white men that love books tribe, that is like you feel an obligation to challenge that. And I think our allegiances to our tribes often force us into these outrage exchanges, not necessarily because we personally feel affronted, but because we feel we are supposed to represent our tribes, be it women speaking up, be it black people speaking up, be it book lovers speaking up, be it Harry Potter fans speaking up. It's, you see these little communities that swell whenever there is a challenge to the tribe, and often the response is just completely disproportionate to what triggered it. But we just create such a noise around something that actually maybe never needed that much attention in the first place. And I'm really noticing that now. I'm really noticing those things that on paper should anger me, should outrage me on paper. But in practice, I won't allow it to. And honestly, just for my own mental health, channeling my outrage has been has lifted a real weight.
I think that the white men who love books tribe needs a rebrand. I'm not sure that's gonna it's not a club I want to be a part of.
It's a working title.
It's a working title, yeah. I mean, we've spoken a little bit about how we've both seen social media change over the last sort of 10 years or so. And if we are at a moment which may sort of act as a kind of a marker, because I think it does feel quite significant what's happening right now, a tipping point. Do you feel optimistic about what might happen in the next 10 years, or is it just too early to tell?
I feel incredibly optimistic. And you know what? I think what we're seeing now is a generation that has been mobilized. I think if we kind of measure even just the social media era, if we measure it in phases, I think there was a very idle phase where we were just irrationally outraged by some absolute ridiculous things. In the book, I unearthed some of the most ridiculous things we have been outraged by, because they are abundant. There are so many things that we were just, we were engaging with unnecessarily, and we were just in this perpetual cycle of, you know, intense outrage subsides, intense outrage subsides. I think we're now in a space and we're really seeing it in our current time now, where people are realizing that there are new innovative ways to mobilize. And I think the internet could kind of be to the detriment or to the betterment of activism. And I think for a while, it made us idle. It meant that we could voice our outrage without ever really leaving our sofas. But I think people are realizing now that you can use this tool, the internet, to galvanize, to create noise, and then to translate that noise into the real world. And I'm feeling very optimistic that the seeds of change are definitely being planted.